good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Bay State Paranormal Center. My name's John Horrigan, and tonight's lecture is Bay State Phantoms, parentheses, and Monsters. I'm going to give you a chronology, an overview of monsters seen in Massachusetts over the past 400 years. Some of the prose is absolutely dreadful. Feel free to snooze at that point, but I'll try to get through that as much as possible. But I took a sampling from the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, and up to the 21st century of strange occurrences. So that's what we're going to do tonight. And feel free to ask any questions at any time. I really appreciate that you've taken the time to come out. I'm going to be reading a lot to you, so if you want to face forward instead of craning your neck, or you can look at me, it doesn't matter. But we've got a lot to cover here tonight. So this is the wolf creature that is the symbol of my conference that I hold. I'm a folklorist, and basically that means that I don't have a prefix or a suffix following my name, or a mortgage-sized student loan nipping at my heels. I'm a pocket historian. I'm interested in New England history, weather and fires mostly. I've lectured at the Boston Public Library since 1994. My wife calls me scattered and unfocused, which means I'm a producer, writer, podcaster, historical archivist, and historical reenactor. And if I break out into a hockey announcer's voice tonight, I apologize. I'm an itinerant professional sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni, and I'm also the New England Patriots alumni basketball announcer. Long story, different day. But they've been very kind to me. I host a conference. We're going into the fourth year of something called the Mass Monster Mash. Log on to massmonstermash.org. It's Saturday, October 17th, 2009. We've got it locked down. We've got Lauren Coleman, Tom Slick and the Abominable Snowman, Nick Redfern, Chupacabra, Jeff Belanger, White House Ghosts and Other Haunted Places. Chris Balzano will be presenting a lecture called Outside the Bridgewater Triangle. We're going to do something on Loch Ness Monster Photo 75th Anniversary. That's that hoax photo or legend hoax photo. And then we're going to have a Monster Hunters segment with Nick Redfern and how to hunt down monsters. Mike Assorti will be here with Bigfoot Surplus as well, so he'll be there. Other guests will be Tim Banal, who's my partner from banalofamerica.com. He's leading podcaster in the nation. He's also a producer for Coast to Coast. Matt Moniz, you probably know through Spooky South Coast. Matt's been with us since the beginning. Elizabeth will be representing the Bay State Paranormal Center. Derek Gunn, who's spoken here, and Tom D'Agostino, a popular author of New England Ghosts. Saturday the 17th. The night before will be the Mass UFO Show. And right now we've got Cosmic Crashes, UFO Wreckage, that's Nick Redfern. The Bentwaters Incident, Peter Robbins, that's the incident that took place in December of 1980. A UFO seen between two military bases, one occupied by the Brits, one by the Americans. Tim will speak about the state of ufology. I may talk about the air raid of Los Angeles, which segues into my talk next week. A week from tonight, I'm going to be doing a debut lecture about the air raid of Los Angeles, which is a UFO encounter that took place in 1942 in Los Angeles. Still hasn't been explained. And if you want to go attend that free of charge, just sign up with Elizabeth after tonight, and you get a free pass. In fact, any of my talks you go to, as long as you come, you get to go to the next one free. Anyways, that's the Friday night. Unexplained UFO videos, but you're welcome. That's ufoshow.org or massmonstermash.org, Friday the 16th of October, Saturday the 17th. And then I also have something called the New England History Festival in Watertown as well on Saturday the 14th. I call it Historipalooza. I basically get historical reenactors, come up on stage, do 30 minutes, and then we throw on the next act, like a historical Woodstock. Tonight, what's my definition of a phantom or a monster? Sea monsters, Bigfoot, strange lights, ghosts, out-of-place animals, or oop animals, real animals, murderers, invaders. What's the Bridgewater Triangle? What about some New England legends, 1638 to 2008? Come on in. We got one more here, I think. Okay. Deadly creatures in Massachusetts, evil people, questions and answers. And again, you can jump in when you want. What's a monster? Well, it's a legendary animal combining features of animal and human form or having the forms of various animals in combination, as a centaur, griffin, or sphinx. Any creature so ugly or monstrous as to frighten people. Any animal or human grotesquely deviating from the normal shape, behavior, or character. A person who excites horror by wickedness, cruelty, etc. Huge, enormous, monstrous. What's a phantom? An apparition or a specter. An appearance or illusion without material substance as a dream image, mirage, or optical illusion. A person or thing of merely illusory power, status, the phantom of fear, of pertaining to or of the nature of a phantom, illusory, a phantom sea serpent. So when you talk about this area, we're in the Bridgewater Triangle, and everybody who does not know what the Bridgewater Triangle is, raise your hand. Oh, okay. So it's an anomalous area of about 200 square miles with the apex of the triangle basically in Abington. It swings down to the southeastern corner to Freetown, to the southwestern to Rehoboth. And basically, there's been cases of Bigfoot, UFOs, thunderbirds or giant birds being seen there, giant snakes, giant dogs, cattle mutilation, phantom pumas or phantom cougars, ghosts, amongst them the famous one being the red-headed hitchhiker of Route 44, phantom fires, you got a creepy lake called Lake Nip, Anawan Rock, Profile Rock, Dighton Rock, Native American ghosts, balls of light, spook lights, on and on and on, a lot of ghosts as well, haunted schoolhouse. But it's an area that is basically the inside that area is called the Hockomock Swamp, which basically means a place where evil spirits dwell. And that is not your vision, that's just a bad exposure. But that's basically where it exists. And of course, we're along Route 44 here, and that's where the red-headed hitchhiker of Route 44, legend has it, I'll talk about that later, can be seen on the Seekonk Rehoboth line near where the sign is. If you honk your horn three times and flash your lights three times, allegedly the hitchhiker will show up in your back seat. When I honked my horn three times and flashed my lights three times, I got pulled over by the cops. So, so Taunton State Hospital, a lot of people, that was used for heinous experiments, and people were held hostage there, treated very, very poorly, kind of like what your modern-day nursing homes do today to our grandparents. But I'm sorry, I'm going to be a servant. But there's all sorts of things you can see. The Hornbine School, which is a neat school down the bottom there, right here. That's a haunted schoolhouse. People report seeing a spectral teacher and students, hearing children laughing. Then the red-headed hitchhiker, etc. So it's in Stonehill College over here. It's where people report hearing a little girl crying and laughing, etc. And, of course, my pompous, arrogant CD starring Chris Balzano and Chris Pittman is on sale tonight for only $5. How are you?
Fine. How are you today?
Good. Come on in.
I think you got a couple of seats.
You banged out the joint tonight, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
All right. First one. This is a chronology, as I mentioned, 400 years. So stick with me. I'll try to drive through some of this absolutely horrible prose. But this is Cape Ann Sea Monster, the historian in me, 1638. Okay? Now, keep in mind that Boston was settled in 1630, Plymouth in 1620. So it's right off the bat. And quote, this is a report by John Jocelyn. And it's one of the earliest sightings of an animal that would haunt the coast of New England, especially Gloucester. Quote, they told me of a sea serpent, or snake, that lay coiled up like a cable upon the rock at Cape Ann. A boat passing by with English on board and two Indians, they would have shot the serpent, but the Indians dissuaded them, saying that if he were not killed outright, they would all be in danger of their lives. So that's the earliest account I could find of a sea monster. Now this account came to me through the brilliant research of Chris Pittman. I don't know if you've heard of him. Basically, it comes from the history of New England from John Winthrop's book, 1630 to 1639. And we think it's 1639 because the calendar shifted from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. And James Everill, who was known as a sober or discreet man, according to Winthrop, and two companions boarded a little boat and set out for a trip on the Muddy River. It's an estuary off the Charles in Boston. They had been moving downstream for about a mile when the night's mysterious events began. The three men were suddenly confronted with the appearance of a huge, bright light hovering in the sky. The light flamed up as it hovered and appeared to be about 3 yards square, and as they watched, the light contracted into the figure of a swine and moved swift as an arrow in the direction of Charlestown. For 2 or 3 hours, the unidentified light moved back and forth in the sky between Everill's location and Charlestown. When the light finally disappeared, the men noticed to their dismay that they had somehow been carried against the tide back to the place where they had started. And of course, this smacks of what's known as missing time. If you're familiar with UFO encounters, people that claim to have interacted or encountered a UFO oftentimes report that they lost 4 hours of their life and they can't account for it. So this is kind of neat that it's 1639 of a strange light. They only relate it to something that they know, which is a swine or their cattle, and they have missing time. Back to Lynn, 1641. Again, this is bad prose, but here we go. Obadiah Turner, okay, and Lynn, quote, "Some being on ye great..." There's going to be a ton of ye's here, so bear with it. "Some being on ye great beach, gathering of calms and seaweed, which had been cast thereon by ye mighty storm, did spy a most wonderful serpent, a short way off from ye shore. He was big round in ye thickest part as a wine pipe, and they do affirm that he was 15 fathoms, that's 90 feet, or more in length." So he's a big boy. "A most wonderful tale, but ye witnesses be credible, and it would be of no account to them to tell an untrue tale. We have likewise heard yet that Cape Ann ye people have seen a monster like unto this, which did there come out of ye land, much to ye terror of them yet did see him. Ye, ye, ye." So you're going to see in this area, there's a history of sea serpents in the Cape Ann, Gloucester area, which is north of Boston, and it will culminate in a spectacular sighting of the Gloucester sea serpent that we'll talk about in just a little while in 1817 through 1819. Of course, we had the Salem witch trials, right? You can see, look at this poor Giles Corey, huh? He's getting pressed. I don't think he had a bad day. They accused him of being a witch. And basically, if you know the Salem witch trials, three girls basically started having fainting spells in court and accusing people of being witches. This is the overview story. I liken them to being the first American actresses. These three, because they were putting up a storm, and their parents are very, very powerful people within the community of Salem, and they all had to do is point to a person, call them a witch, male or female, and they would be taken care of. 19 were accused of witchery and hanged at Gallows Hill in Salem. Most of the Salem witches were not from Salem. Most of the accused in 1692 came from Andover, North Shore, and Salem Village, which is now Danvers. So from 1692 to 1693, 168 people were accused and thrown into jails, and notably Salem's witch dungeon. Has everybody been to Salem and seen the witch dungeon? Pretty cool place. Don't go during Halloween. You'll never be able to move around. But there were basically three women that hung around with this a Haitian housemaid who was familiar with voodoo. And it was just a really terrible time in American, the period of America in 1692 and 1693. And like I said, poor Giles Corey. Everybody got to place a rock on that board as he got pressed. Now, the unknown story of 1692 that year is something called the Spectre Leaguers. And it's a very famous case. It's reported first by Cotton Mather in his Magnalia Christi. And this is what Mather said, and again, more horrific prose, but we'll work through it. "In the midsummer time in the year 1692, of fatal memory, Ebenezer Babson, a sturdy yeoman of Cape Ann, with the rest of his family, almost every night heard noises as if some persons were walking or running hither and thither about the house. He being out late one night, when returning home, saw two men come out of his own door, and then at the sight of him run swiftly from the end of the house into the adjoining cornfields." So he's coming home and he sees ghosts run out of his house. "Going in, he immediately questioned his family concerning these strange visitors. They promptly replied that no one at all had been there during his absence. So upon this, expecting an immediate attack, the whole family rose in consternation and went with all haste to the nearest garrison, which was only a short distance off. They had only just entered it when..." I'm going to turn off my cell phone, because usually when I tell people to turn off their cell phones, mine ends up ringing. So anyways, "Upon this, expecting an immediate attack, the whole family rose in consternation and went with all haste to the nearest garrison, which was only a short distance off." In other words, a garrison, it was a fortress, a fort that had armed soldiers in it. "They had only just entered it when they heard heavy footfalls, as if a number of men were trampling on the ground around it and chasing them. So one, however, they surrounded and hemmed in, and Babson, getting a fair shot at him, saw him drop." So he gets a shot off at one of these creatures, and he sees it fall. "But when the search was made, the dead body had vanished. And after a fruitless hunt, during which the stout-hearted colonists heard a loud talking going on in the swamp, in some outlandish jargon that they could not understand a word of, they returned, crestfallen and half-dead with fatigue, to the garrison in order to report their ill success. But no sooner were they back there than they saw more men skulking around the bushes, who prudently kept out of gunshot range. What could it all mean? In the course of a few days more, two of the garrison went out upon a scout, who saw several men come out of an orchard in which they seemed to be performing some strange incantations. They counted 11 of them. Richard Dolliver raised his gun and fired into the midst of them, where they stood the thickest, but of course without other effect than to make them scatter as before. No bodies were found. But whatever these entities were, they threw stones at houses, they beat up on barns with clubs, and otherwise acted more in the spirit of diabolical revelry than as if actuated by any deadlier purpose. So you got a lot going on here. You have ghosts. Are they Indians? Are they Native Americans that are haunting the residents up here? There's even, some could argue, there's an alien connotation there, as if they're occupants from some spaceship. But it's a very bizarre case known as the Spectre Leaguers of 1692. I could go in much further depth, but we have to move on here. This is what? Anawan Rock. And what's Anawan Rock? Well, the death of King Philip, who was sachem of the Wampanoags. People have reported hearing voices in a Native American tongue here. They've reported the sound of arrows whizzing by their head. Chris Balzano and Tom D'Agostino have done extensive research on this. People have reported seeing and smelling phantom campfires at the top of Anawan Rock. And again, King Philip's War took place from 1675 to 1676. Absolutely horrific bloodbath between the colonists and the Native Americans, Narragansetts, Wampanoags of New England. And this, it would begin the purging and killing that would go on for another 220 years in America. We don't really get taught this, but as we pushed westward, as the Anglo-Saxon moved westward, especially after the Civil War, the heinous atrocities that they committed against Native Americans and the butchery, absolutely savage. And if you're ghost hunters around here, I'm not a ghost hunter, but I'm sure if you go to some of those old towns, that there's a lot of Native American spirits hanging around, and I bet you they're pissed off. 1704, this is the first wolf attacks. I like to study out-of-place animals and animals that are dangerous. Well, in 1704, the town of Newbury suffered a wolf attack, okay? And what they did is they voted to pay a bounty to men who had killed the two wolves on Plum Island. So the wolves were a threat to the cattle, the sheep, the pigs, and the people on Plum Island. So in the summer, farmers from nearby towns used the meadows for pasture. And in winter, they fed their livestock salt hay harvested from the island's abundant marshes. But in 1704, because of the activity of these wolves, they couldn't go out there. So they hired two men to hunt these monstrous wolves. They never bagged them, and the wolves just disappeared. Later in 1752 in France, there was a similar story called The Beast of Le Jovedan, which was a killer wolf, a monstrous wolf that was ripping out throats of people, attacking people. It killed over a dozen people in a village in northern France. The Bridgewater Triangle. This is something called the Norton Devil Footprints. And basically, it goes like this. Major George Leonard died in 1716. And the local townspeople of 18th century Norton were suspicious of Leonard's wealth. Some accused him of selling his soul to the devil to achieve such riches. When he died, according to folklore, the devil appeared at Leonard's mansion to claim his body, and the devil left the mansion by leaping out of the window, and by the impact supposedly left deep cloven hoof prints in the rock below. Today, the Leonard mansion is no longer there, but those devil footprints remain, and they are among the sightseeing destinations listed on the Southeastern Massachusetts Convention and Visitors Bureau's website. So if you're ever there, it's located on the Rose Farm property at the junction of West Main and North Worcester Streets in Norton. Again, I'll tell you, I'm not a ghost person at all. I don't know anything about ghosts. I'm a cryptozoologist guy, and I study ufology and historical paranormal phenomena. But the White Witch of Littleton, what struck my interest, and you'll see in a while, is the natural phenomena that accompanies this. But in 1720, Mrs. Samuel Dudley, her name was Abigail, was the wife of Littleton's first town clerk and selectman, and she was being harassed by three young girls. We've heard that before, haven't we, in Salem? And they would go into fits whenever she was around, and this was exactly the practice of the parish girls in Salem in 1692, whose behavior and accusations of bewitchments instigated the Salem witch trials and eventual executions. While true to form, the three Littleton girls asserted that Mrs. Dudley was bewitching them and was the cause of their apparent fits and predicaments as well. And this is what caught my attention. They said that she could make the earth shake. And it happened when the girls went by her home. And they called her the White Witch due to her complexion. Well, she was brought up on charges, and finally the girls' family moved to Medford because they confessed that they had made it up. And Medford's minister, Reverend Ebenezer Terrell, forgave them, but right before they were going to put this woman to death, they acquitted her. Now, the reason why I put this in is because Littleton is a very, very active seismological zone. There's a lot of earthquakes. There's a fault line that runs through Littleton, Massachusetts. In fact, on October 19, 2007, there was a 2.5 earthquake there. So I found it ironic that when the little girls went by her house and I saw this passage that she could make the earth shake. It's Littleton, and it's an active seismological area. Now, most people who spend any time looking at the paranormal come to believe in the real estate law that says people selling a house have to disclose tragedies that have occurred in the residence, including any rumors of paranormal activity. Well, this law gained legendary status. And one such trial happened in the year 1733 in Plymouth. And I got to tell you this about Plymouth, just from a historical perspective. There were some weird cats living down there. They settled in 1620. They established the country, but they just got weirder and weirder and cult-like as the end of the 17th century drew to a close. So that's my only editorial against Plymouth. Quakers and Puritans sometimes go off the deep end. One such trial in 1733. So a man that was suing this time, that filed the suit, was not the one tormented by ghosts, but the man who was cheated by the tenants of the house accused. Basically, in the fall of 1733, the house on Coal Hill in Plymouth, Mass., had been abandoned and its reputation solidified in the minds of the community. There was no shortage of belief in ghosts and of the devil as a man who might walk the streets on any given night in Plymouth. Plymouth was common among its New England neighbors, a culture of fear and superstition, where cannons were shot to force demons to leave the town as a cure of smallpox. And also, people would put hexagons on their barns to ward off evil spirits. And they'd make home remedies in their kitchens as they had Bibles by their fires. And of course, if you got sick, they would bleed you, which is that age-old institution where they cut you and drain out your blood. Hopefully, you'd get better before you died of bleeding to death. Anyways, in this context, the Phillips house stood out. Now, the owner of this house was Josiah Cotton, who was a prominent member of the community and a strict Calvinist who disdained belief in the paranormal. Well, like many early settlers, he had lost most of his children during childbirth or from disease, but he held on to his daughter, Hannah. Well, she married a Captain Thompson Phillips, who built the house on Coal Hill, and they had one child. Well, shortly after the marriage, Phillips was lost at sea. Hannah remarried and moved to Boston, but died later that year of smallpox. So Josiah Cotton, the grandfather, was given custody of his granddaughter. And he also inherited the house and all of the Phillips debts in Plymouth on Coal Hill. So his own financial standing had started to become shaky, due in part to the costs of raising his grandchild, his own son's education at Harvard, and several bad investments. So he decided to sell the house, knowing that he could raise more money quicker if he sold it rather than renting it out. But he was unable to find a buyer willing to pay enough and eventually decided to rent it out. So in 1732, he reached a verbal agreement with a guy named John Clark, a blacksmith, who decided to use the house as a residence for himself and his business partner, as well as a workshop. Well, they move in with their family and the business partner's family, and there seems to have been an argument between the landlord and the tenant a little over a year later. Cotton wanted somebody else to share the house, forcing Clark to split the space and give up his bedroom. Well, people witnessed the men arguing, and Cotton later testified that Clark claimed that he would start rumors about the landlord and he would say that the house is haunted. So by 1733, Clark and his partner moved out. They refused to pay the rent that they owned. And this man, Josiah Cotton, had to take them to court. Their claim was that unseen hands moved furniture or rattled the walls throughout the house. There were unexplained noises, including groans that sometimes became so loud and disturbing, other people in the neighborhood were awoken by them. They'd see unusual lights, a bluish light that was seen by people in the surrounding houses. And cats, wolves, and the moon helped explain away most of that because they thought the moon was causing the light, which was reflecting off a pane of glass. But it was a very strange case. And in the end, Josiah Cotton won the lawsuit that his tenants had to pay back rent. He proved that his house was not haunted. And that's why I found that unique. The Witch's Bridge. Well, this is It's known as the Power Street Bridge or the Ann Cobb Bridge in Norton, or known as the Witch's Bridge. And basically, a woman named Ann Cobb was accused of dealing with black arts and working with Old Scratch, which is the nickname of the devil. It was not known how or where she got her power, but people believe that she did have it. Well, Ann Cobb died in 1798, and shortly afterwards, the bridge near her home was named Witch's Bridge. And people say that it would cause trouble to anybody that crossed over the bridge. The cattle would disappear, or wheels would fall off wagons. One person fell off the bridge and banged their head and died. But it was allegedly a haunted bridge called the Witch's Bridge in Norton. Now, we mentioned this Gloucester sea serpent, and basically a tremendous spate of sea serpent sightings took place in the early 19th century. Woman by the name of June, I forget her name, she wrote The Great New England Sea Serpent. I should know her name, a friend of mine that I've communicated with. Anyways, it's called The Great New England Sea Serpent, great book if you're interested. It started in 1817, August, when two women claimed that they had seen a creature swimming in the harbor. The same sea serpent was seen at almost the same time by the captain of a coasting vessel. This serpent seen by so many sailors and fishermen, which it makes you lend credence or want to lend credence to these sightings that they did see something totally unusual. Well, anyways, a few days later in August of 1817, Mrs. Amos Story said that she saw what appeared to be a tree trunk washed up on the rocks of 10 Pound Island in Gloucester, which lies in the harbor. But as she watched it through her telescope, it moved, and when she looked again, it was gone. William Rowe reported seeing a creature that its head was as broad as a horse or more, but not quite as long. And the same day, Amos Story, whose wife had seen it earlier, also saw the creature. Quote, "It was between the hours of 12 and 1 o'clock when I first saw him, and he continued in sight for an hour and a half, and I was sitting on the shore and was about 20 rods from him when he was nearest to me. His head appeared shaped much like that of a sea turtle, but he carried his head from 10 to 12 inches above the water, and his head at that distance appeared larger than the head of any dog. From the back of his head to the next part of him that was visible, I should judge that it was 3 or 4 feet, and he moved very rapidly through the water, and I should say at least a mile or two in 3 minutes. So this thing is really moving along, 20 miles an hour. I saw no bunches on its back, and on this day I did not see more than 10 or 12 feet of his body. 2 days later, August 12th, another shipmaster, Solomon Allen III, saw it. He said, his head formed something like the head of a rattlesnake, but nearly as large as the head of a horse. When he moved on the surface of the water, his motion was slow, at times playing in circles, and sometimes moving straight forward. Another guy, 2 days after that, August 14th, Matthew Gaffney. And he does what any American would do if he doesn't understand something. He goes gets his gun and shoots at it. I had a good gun and took good aim. I aimed at his head, and I think I must have hit him, because he turned towards us immediately after I fired, and I thought he was coming right at us. But he sunk down and went directly under our boat and made his appearance at about 100 yards from where he sunk. More sightings. Here's one. This is from Cheever Felch aboard the United States schooner Science. Quote, and this is also in early 1818. His color is dark brown with white under his throat. His size we could not accurately ascertain, but his head is about 3 feet in circumference, flat and much smaller than his body. We did not see his tail, but from the end of the head to the farthest protuberance was not far from 100 feet. That's a big baby here. He goes on to talk about the first one to say the first hump that they saw was 10 to 12 feet from its head. So the sightings continue all throughout 1817, 1818, and into 1819 in Gloucester. And in fact, reports of New England coastal sea serpent sightings had 12 sightings of this thing in 1839, 9 sightings in 1875, and 13 in 1886. So there's a total of 190 sightings for 100 years. And a total of 56 sightings took place in the 20th century from 1900 to 1950. So judge for yourself, but this is in the lore and the annals of history in Gloucester about this Gloucester sea serpent. Now look at the scale in terms of the longboats compared to this sea serpent. And again, they took license here with the way I'm sure that they described them. And I can't think of any animal. They knew what whales were. They knew most of the coastal creatures that were around there, and they describe it as being a serpentine anomaly. But who knows? Next up. It's called Powder Sare. I know, I want to buy a vowel there, you know, and I want to reverse the E and the R, but that's how they spell it, P-W-D-R-E. Powder Sare, star jelly, or angel hair. Now, this is phenomena is usually associated with UFOs, and the reason why I selected this one because of the date of October 26, 1846. Novice ufologists think that the modern UFO age began on June 24, 1947, when Kenneth Arnold sighted some saucers, as he called them, skipping across the sky. But in fact, if you do some research, which I have, the Roswell incident doesn't take place on July 4th, 1947. If you do the research, you'll find that Mac Brazel's talking about the Roswell crash taking place between June 14th and June 20th, 1947. But anyways, this is October 26, 1846. A big, luminous, flying disc is reported dropping a lump of fetid-smelling jelly over Lowell. Now, we all know that Lowell still stinks to this day. Sorry. Allegedly, the mass was retrieved and was found to weigh 442 pounds and measured 4 feet in diameter. Star jelly, or powder sare, is a compound purportedly deposited on the Earth during meteor showers. And it's described as being foul-smelling, gelatinous substance which tends to evaporate shortly after having fallen. Its cobweb-like filaments are called angel hair. So some major UFO sightings are usually accompanied by star jelly. The old coot. Wouldn't be a lecture without a Civil War ghost here. North Adams, a farmer by the name of William Saunders, leaves home in 1861 to fight for the Union. Well, about a year later, his wife, Belle, receives a report that her husband had been gravely wounded and died in a military hospital. That was the last she had heard of him, and alone and in need of help, she hired a local man to work the farm with her. Later, she married the man, and he adopted her children. So in 1865, a bearded, ragged man wearing a Union blue uniform steps off the train in North Adams. You can guess who returned home. It was Saunders. And he walked to his farm, and while standing outside, he saw his wife and happy family, a man that he didn't know, and his children calling that man Daddy. Well, he was crushed, and he turned on his heels and walked away, heading towards Mount Greylock, where he built a shack in the remote Bellows Pipe area. He lived the rest of his days there, almost a hermit, hiring himself out occasionally to farms, and he was known to locals as the Old Coot. Well, war and time had ravaged his appearance, and no one recognized him, and it said that he even worked his old spread on occasion. So they said that Old Coot was insane. And when he died, though, on one winter's day, hunters came upon the shack to find him dead, and they were startled to see a spirit fly from his body. And to this day, his bedraggled spirit is sometimes seen on Mount Greylock. That is, an old man in a Union blue Civil War coat is seen traipsing through the snow in winters on Mount Greylock. Don't go on the Bellows Pipe Trail after dark, is what they say. Now, this is the Lady in Black. And only one ghost haunts Fort Warren, which is on the Boston Harbor Islands. And the Lady in Black, as she's come to be called, is very persistent. Well, her name is Melanie Lanier, and her husband Samuel was imprisoned at the fort during the Civil War because he was a sympathizer for the South, for the Confederates. Well, she slipped into the prison and attempted to free him and a dozen other Confederate soldiers. And basically, this is what happened. She's trying to break out her husband who's in this prison. So she chooses a dark, rainy, moonless night. And she rode across Nantasket Road and finally landed on the beach at George's Island. Slipping noiselessly by the sentries, she reached the ditch under the corridor of dungeons. After giving a prearranged signal, she was hoisted up to the cannonade embrasure and pulled through the opening. As soon as the husband and wife had exchanged greetings, they made plans for the future. The prisoners decided to dig their way out of the dungeon and into the parade ground and set to work. But unfortunately for their plans, a slight miscalculation brought their tunnel within the hearing of Northern soldiers who were stationed at the other side of the wall. The commanding officer, a Colonel Dimmock, was notified, and the whole scheme was quickly exposed. The brave little woman, when cornered, attempted to fire at the colonel. But unfortunately, the gun was an old-fashioned pepper box type and exploded, backfiring, killing her husband. Colonel Dimmock had no alternative but to sentence her to hang her as a spy. And that's what they did. They hung her, but she was wearing black robes during this time. It was February 7th, 1862. And since she was wearing this black robe when she was hung, various people have reported that they've seen this ghost of the Lady in Black.
Once, three soldiers were walking under the great arched sally port at the entrance to the fort, and there before them, in the fresh snow, were five impressions of a girl's shoe leading nowhere and coming from nowhere. Another case, 10 years before World War II, a certain sergeant from Fort Banks was climbing to the top of the ladder which leads to the corridor of dungeons when he heard a voice warning him, saying, "Don't come in here." Needless to say, he did not venture any further. There's been a number of court-martials on record of men who have shot at ghost-like figures while on sentry duty. And one man deserted his post, claiming that he had seen the ghost and was chased by the Lady of the Black Robes. So there's a lot of stories about this ghost, the Lady in Black. One more. After Melanie died in 1862, Richard Cassidy, a soldier, was stationed at his post. It was late in the evening when he felt a small, sharp pain as a pair of hands slipped out of the darkness and clutched his throat. Twisting around, he saw Melanie's spirit. She was dressed in the black gown that she was wearing when she died. Terrified, Cassidy wrenched himself loose from her hands and ran off, and he was sentenced to 30 days of solitary confinement for leaving his post. So, the Lady in Black is a classic Boston Harbor legend. Now, this is the largest jellyfish. I know, it's weird. I bring a lot of weird creatures here. But in 1865, a giant lion's mane jellyfish was found in the Massachusetts Bay. This thing's huge. The bell was 7.5 feet, and its tentacles measured 120 feet long and a width of 245 feet. This was a big baby, and it was coming into Boston Harbor. Hoosac Tunnel. Anybody been out here? Oh, great. Excellent. Basically, this tunnel was known as the Bloody Pit. By the time it was completed, it took 25 years, and they started in 1851 building it, but almost 200 men had died in what known because they died in fires, explosions, tunnel collapses, and in one case by the hand of the other. And it was the cold-blooded murder that occurred in 1865 that would give the tunnel its reputation for ghosts. The construction crew of the Hoosac Tunnel would have the honor of being among the first crews to use it. Well, in the afternoon of March 20th, 1865, three explosive experts named Ned Brinkman, Billy Nash, and Ringo Kelly decided to use nitro to continue their work on the tunnel. They were going to use it as an explosive. They placed a charge and then ran back towards a safety bunker that would shield them from the effects of the blast. Brinkman and Nash never made it there, however, because for some reason Ringo Kelly set off the charge before other men could make it to their shelter. The two men were buried alive under tons of rocks, and soon after the accident, Kelly vanished without a trace, leading many to believe that the accident with the nitro may have not been an accident after all. He was not seen again until March 30th, 1866. This is Ringo Kelly, when his body was discovered 2 miles inside the tunnel. It was found at almost exact same spot where Brinkman and Nash had been killed. So the authorities quickly deduced that Kelly had been strangled to death. Deputy Sheriff Charles Gibson estimated that he had been murdered between midnight and 3:30 a.m. that morning. The death was thoroughly investigated, but no suspects were ever rounded up. So, in 1868 then, the construction site was toured by a man by the name of Paul Travers, a mechanical engineer and a respected cavalry officer during the Civil War, and he received a letter from a Mr. Dunn of the construction company who had asked him to come and examine the tunnel. Well, apparently, the workers had complained constantly of hearing a man's voice cry out in agony. And needless to say, they were very scared and hesitant to enter into the tunnel. So Travers and Dunn said, "Look, we're going to check this out." And they went out to the site on September 8th, 1868, and the former military officer did not soon forget what he encountered there. He later wrote a letter to his sister and told about the weird experience. Quote, "Dunn and I entered the tunnel at exactly 9 p.m. We traveled about 2 miles into the shaft, and then we stopped to listen. As we stood there in the cold silence, we both heard what truly sounded like a man groaning out in pain. As you know, I've heard the same sound many times during the war, and I know what it sounds like when a man is groaning in pain. Yet when we turned up our wicks on our lamps, there were no human beings in the shaft except for Dunn and myself. I haven't been this frightened since Shiloh, which is a battle in the Civil War. A month after his investigation, October 17th, 1868, the worst disaster to occur in the tunnel's history took place as a gas explosion blew apart the water pumping station on the surface and 13 miners were killed when debris filled the tunnel. So other people have now reported that that they've heard miners calling out inside of Hoosac Tunnel. Another man by the name of Dr. Clifford J. Owen went in June of 1872 and was accompanied by a drilling superintendent, and they claim to have heard the voices. 1874, A man, a hunter, went missing, Frank Webster. His body's found dead inside the tunnel. They claim that they saw ghostly figures surrounding his body. A headless track walker. It never ceases to amaze me that how many headless track walkers there are associated with train tracks. Now, they didn't have iPods back then, so they must have been able to hear the train coming, but how do they lose their head and they still keep walking? I know not. It's in far western Massachusetts in the Berkshires. What's the exact town of that?
Florida, North Adams.
Florida, North Adams, okay. Now, one of the things that happens is, you know, Orville and Wilbur Wright flew,
right, 1903.
Well, there was a scare ship mystery over Massachusetts. And it started right down here in Bridgewater. October 31st, 1908, two undertakers, John E. Flynn and Philip Prophet, spotted a strange light in the sky while driving their carriage into Bridgewater proper around 4 a.m. Flynn described it as not exactly a searchlight, but an unusually strong lantern of some sort that hung below a balloon-shaped object. The light reportedly descended towards the ground rapidly and then ascended just as quickly. Both undertakers watched the light for 40 minutes as it traveled perpendicular to the ground, steadily and silently, until it finally disappeared over the skies of Plymouth. And, quote, the Manchester Union Leader said that all of the balloons in which ascensions are made in this Massachusetts state were certainly accounted for. So it's a classic UFO-type sighting of a light just hanging in the sky. And what happened later that year, on December 24th of 1909, next year actually, a man by the name of Wallace Tillinghast, a newspaper article shows up, and it shows up in the Willimantic Connecticut Chronicle. And basically it says, craft of mystery finally tracked to its lair, perhaps. Home of the Worcester Aeroplane, located in West Boylston, Massachusetts, it is believed. Shed is in the dense woods on the J.B. Goff estate, and while trying to get close to the place, United Press representative was captured, hailed before Justice of the Peace, and fined for trespassing. So, it's Christmas Eve, 1909. In the home of the mysterious aeroplane, which has been cruising at unheard altitudes over Massachusetts for the last two nights and causing wonderment to thousands, it is believed has been found. Scouring the country about Worcester in search for the home of the Tillinghast machine, they're naming it after this guy, this inventor, Wallace Tillinghast, a United Press representative discovered at West Boylston, 6 miles from the city, that 14 men in the employ of Paul B. Morgan of Morgan Construction Company of Worcester were busy in some secret occupation on the estate of John B. Goff, the old-time temperance lecturer. Talked about not drinking. On this estate, and situated in dense woods, there is a shed more than 100 feet long, which it is believed contains the aeroplane that was startling the world. No aeroplane was seen by the United Press representative, however, because as he was advancing through the woods to reconnoiter, he was captured by some of the men employed on the estate, hailed before a justice of the peace, and fined for trespassing. 2 years ago, Morgan spent $15,000 with Wallace E. Tillinghast on this aeroplane. And again, an aeroplane could be like this. It doesn't necessarily have to have wings. They're talking about some sort of air vehicle. And it said that Tillinghast bought the design off a Swedish aviator. And basically, thousands of people all over Massachusetts saw it. Between 6 o'clock on December 23rd, 1909, until midnight, its flashlights were trailed from Marlborough to Fitchburg and back through Worcester to Boston, Natick, Wellesley, Newton, Needham, and then it passed to the northeast, circling Chelsea, Revere, Lynn, Salem. This is a major sighting of whatever this is. And again, it did not resemble the monoplane of the type used by Latham and Blériot, who were two famous French aviators who were flying at that time. But a fascinating story about the airship flap of 1908 and 1909, which is centralized in Massachusetts. A wolf hunt, another one. This happened on April 10th, 1913. The first wolf hunt of this city that has been seen since the Algonquins left town took place today along the railroad banks of the South Cove. Police reserves and a score of railroad employees participated in it. They captured the quarry only when he had become confused in the network of tracks and switching wires in the train yard. The wolf, a large gray animal which was bound by express train from Cambridge, Ohio to Lynn, gnawed his way out of a wooden crate as his express drew into South Station. Dashing through the station, he stampeded 1,000 homegoing commuters and then had a clear path through Dewey Square, down Atlantic Avenue to Dover Street, where he again entered the railroad yards. A hurried call to two police stations was answered by bluecoats, who, reinforced by railroad, made it a prisoner of the beast after an hour's careful maneuvering. So I thought it was kind of cool that a wolf escapes in South Station and is terrifying people. One of the things, and again, you may argue if this is a phantom or not, but people don't know that there were U-boat attacks on Massachusetts and New England during both World War I and World War II. In 1918, July 21st, a U-boat during World War I, a German U-boat, surfaced. They call it the Battle of Orleans, in Orleans Harbor, and it fired upon a tugboat called the Perth Amboy that was towing four wooden barges and sank it. Then it submerged and went right back out to sea. It was at Nauset. And there have been other U-boat attacks. There was a U-boat attack in 1944 off the coast of Maine that actually shot down a blimp. One of the cool things that I'll be talking about next week during my Air Raid of Los Angeles talk is this headline, which is really freaky. December 8th, 1941. It's the day after Pearl Harbor. Yet you have this: New York-bound enemy planes alarm entire Northeast. There was an air raid over Boston, New England, and New York. People were seeing enemy planes, German planes, flying over New England. Totally weird. I can't figure it out. There's no aircraft carrier operational in the German Navy. The Japs certainly weren't in the Atlantic, but I have one for San Francisco as well. The next day, that planes were apparently seen over Golden Gate Bridge. I know, weird history. Don't understand it. And of course, if anybody's ever seen the movie The Russians Are Coming, it's a great movie, Alan Arkin, fantastic. It takes place on, I think, Martha's Vineyard, and it's basically about a Russian sub that comes ashore. Well, in Gurnet Point in Duxbury Beach or Humrock, there's a story that a German U-boat sent a raft ashore, and some of the German soldiers reconnoitered the area, broke into a tool shed, took some supplies, paddled back out to their U-boat, and they went out to sea. But that's a phantom, I guess, during World War II. We're cooking. We're well past the halfway point here, folks. So, 1952, Salem. Now, this is a famous, arguably the most famous UFO photograph in the history of Massachusetts. It's taken by Coast Guard on July 16, 1952, during the peak of the 1952 UFO flap. There was another big UFO flap in 1947, another one in 1966. We're going to look at a case out of 66. But anyway, Shell Alpert is a United States Coast Guard seaman on duty in the Coast Guard weather office at the Salem Coast Guard Station when he saw four brilliant lights in the sky. So he called another guardsman to see the lights, but in those few seconds, the lights had become more dim. When they brightened again, he took a single photograph through the window of the office. And this photo has been published many, many times in books, newspapers, and magazines. It was taken at 9:35 a.m. on July 16th, 1952. I'm not going to get into this one, just the weather freak in me, but the Worcester tornado. A tornado that was just absolutely devastating struck on June 9th, 1953 at 5:08 p.m. It just made 10,000 people homeless. It injured 1,300 people, killed nearly 100. And just studying this tornado is on Blue Hills, and it had died out long before it hit Blue Hills. It was raining the Worcester Telegram and Gazette from the sky. In fact, some people's bedding and some artifacts from houses in Worcester were found in Boston Harbor. And what was my favorite one is a guy in Framingham's on his tractor, and he knows the storm's coming, and his wife's waving to him, and he kind of waves back, "Yes, honey." And then she's waving again like this, "Yes, yes, yes, yes." And then she just runs out of the way, and he happens to look over his shoulder. There's the tornado on him, so he's driving his 10-mile-an-hour tractor, jumps off the tractor, lets it keep running into his neighbor's house, and he gets into the bulkhead just as his house is blown away. But so, last major tornado in Massachusetts. This is in my neck of the woods, the Marshfield Sea Monster, July 25th, 1962. On board the ship, the Carol Ann and Vincey. So you had two ships, two corroborating witnesses. They said that they saw this thing that had the head of an alligator and two large fins near its tail and the body of a nail keg. Now, if you talk to some Marshfield fishermen or lobstermen, if they had come out of Ocean's 2 or the Venus Cafe and they'd saw this, I'd say, no, you didn't see anything. But this is before they got to the Ocean Cafe. So Archie Lewis said it was gulping up the fish in the area and did not concern itself with the fishermen in any way. Now, this is that 1966 saucer flap. And this is I like this case because it involves a little girl and the mothers and the friends that don't listen to her. So Nine witnesses would end up seeing this on April 22nd, 1966. It's about 9 p.m. Nancy Meduno, age 11, is laying in her bed when she notices a bright light blinking through her window. She looks out and sees, only 40 feet away, an amazing object the size of an automobile, brightly lit with flashing blue, green, red, and white lights. It's football-shaped, and it made a whizzing, ricocheting sound as it moved over the neighborhood at a very low altitude, just clearing the tops of the houses and trees. As she watched, the thing descended and could be seen behind the trees, apparently landing in the football field behind Beverly High School. Terrified, she runs downstairs to tell her father about what she had seen. He tries to calm her down and then went about adjusting the TV set, which suddenly began to flicker on and off and went to static. Nancy's mother, Claire, was visiting two friends next door, Barbara Smith and Brenda Maria, in an adjoining apartment at the time. So Nancy's father ordered her back to bed, but she became hysterical and refused to leave. At this point, Barbara and Brenda walked in to order a pizza. Seeing Nancy in a fit, the two women attempted to ease her fears and calm her down. They could also see the flashing lights in the field and told Nancy that they would walk over there to prove that it was just an airplane. Well, Barbara and Brenda picked up Claire Meduno, that's the mother, and they walked down a hill to the field. The three women looked up and saw something that they could not have anticipated. There were three objects maneuvering in the sky, halting and circling as if they were playing tag with one another. They were ovoid-shaped with bright flashing lights. Two were distant, but one was much closer, apparently right over the high school field. The women crossed to the field to get a better look. They could see the flashing lights on the edge of the craft changing colors from red to green and blue. Brenda then waved her arms at the object, and it immediately stopped circling and moved across the field towards the women. Well, they were horrified. In her statement, Barbara said that, quote, "It started to come towards us. I started to run." Brenda called up, "Look up. It's directly over us." I looked up and saw a round object, like the bottom of a plate. It was solid, grayish white. I felt this thing was going to come down right on top of me. It was like a giant mushroom. Out of sheer terror, Barbara and Claire turned and ran up the hill. Brenda was still alone in the field, with the thing only 20 feet above her head. She stated, quote, "The object appeared larger and larger as it came closer, and the lights appeared to be all around and turning, and the colors were very bright. When overhead, all I could see was a blurry atmosphere and brightly lit up lights flashing slowly around. I thought it was going to crash on my head." So she turned and fled. She was so petrified by the encounter, she wet her pants. While the women ran back to the apartment, the object slowly moved over to the school. They call the police. The police arrive, and they start joking with the women, saying, "You're probably just imagining it." And then finally, officers Bossy and Mahan, and they said, "Where's this airplane?" And then the witnesses point to the thing at high altitude, looks like a star, and the officers just started laughing. Then suddenly, the disc turned bright red and dropped to a position directly over the school building. At this point, the officers became visibly shaken. Mahan stated, "I observed what seemed to be a large plate hovering over the school. It had three lights, red, green, and blue, but no noise. This object hovered. The lights were flashing. It hovered, then began gliding, and some of the people got on the ground because they were so scared. So they jumped in their cruiser and drove towards the object, and they could see it clearly was not an airplane or a helicopter, and eventually the object floated away. The policemen swear in their testimony that it was not an aircraft." Fascinating story. Ah, the Bridgewater bumper shaker. I'm going to be back here. I talked with Elizabeth. I'm going to be back here next Thursday night, the 28th, to talk about the Air Raid of Los Angeles, which is a great UFO case in 1942, unexplained, and people refuse to acknowledge that it's the first UFO sighting in modern America. A couple of months from now, in July, I'm going to do something on New England Sasquatch. I've collected encounters, Bigfoot encounters from the six New England states dating back to 1850 up to the present.
Is that my Uncle Ron too?
Who's Uncle Ron?
No, I'm joking. I said, "Oh, you met my Uncle Ron too?"
I probably dated your Aunt Ronette. This is April 1970. There was a spate of Bigfoot sightings in the Bridgewater area, the Teachers College, as they call it. Lauren Coleman was one of the ones who investigated this, and it first shows up in his book, Mysterious America, which to me is the Sergeant Pepper of cryptozoology books. If you ever want to get a great book, pick up Mysterious America, classic book, and it talks a lot about the Bridgewater Triangle, because it was Lauren Coleman that coined it, the Bridgewater Triangle. Well, it's April 1970, and residents are complaining of a huge bear, a bipedal bear, walking upright around their houses.
Now, either that's Yogi and Boo Boo with a peanut butter basket or something, but an upright bug. Yo, Boo Boo? And farmers even reported cases of shredded livestock. So you're seeing cattle mutilation. Well, the police investigate these accounts time and time again, but to no avail. So one night, an officer, while on stakeout for the monster, was taken by surprise when something picked up and then violently dropped the rear of his patrol car. The policeman turned the car around to investigate and witnessed, quote, a huge bipedal bear running off between the houses. Classic story of the Bridgewater bumper shaker. This is called the Mans Hill Beach Monster, the Scituate Sea Monster. I was a very, very young boy when this happened, but I remember I was in Dedham at the time, and I had heard about it, and one of my heroes, Edward Rowe Snow, had investigated it. But look at this thing that washed up, 20 feet long and 2 tons. Now, I'm not going to try to sell you on this, but there's a head, right, and it's got fins here. It looks like a dragon, doesn't it? Well, they try to say it's a decayed basking shark. Now, this is how they get at it. If you look at figure C, they're telling you basically that the jaw drops off and it leaves this head, and it's a bunch of nonsense. Decaying basking shark. So check that image out versus that. That doesn't look like no.
The body's too thin.
Yeah, exactly. So I've always had problems with this, but the cryptozoology community, the self-effacing sea serpent experts, have always dismissed this as a decaying basking shark. They won't even give me the time of the day, but you can clearly look at it. I mean, it's a weird-looking creature. But the story of this is, anyways, the thing smelled to high heaven. They buried it over with a bulldozer. People were hacking off pieces of it. The store was selling sea serpent soup. It wasn't made out of that thing, but it was clam chowder. And for that couple of days in November, globsters, as that's called, they were making a commercial killing. November 1970, classic story. Now, Thunderbird. Now, this is also Bridgewater Triangle, a classic one. Chris Pittman, first of all, has some unusual sightings of large birds. He has a 1984 report of two of the creatures fighting each other as they flew over some trees, the Hockomock Swamp. And then there's a Taunton sighting of a bird with a 10 to 12-foot wingspan in 1992. It's summer, 1971, and I've been here. This is Birds Hill, which is in Mansfield Eastern Line. I used to live about an eighth of a mile away from this place. And I investigated the area with Matt Moniz from SpookySouthCoast.com, and we determined that this area is there's a clear cut, first of all, but it's the crest of a hill, and large birds like to be perched on the highest point in the area, whether it's a tree or the crest of a hill. So Thomas Downey, who is a Norton police sergeant, is confronted by a prehistoric creature on a stretch of road near Birds Hill in Easton. It's actually Mansfield. So he reported seeing a 6-foot-tall bird with a wingspan of at least 8 to 12 feet standing in the middle of the street. Downey brought his car to a stop and watched in amazement as the bird flew straight up like a helicopter and disappeared over a nearby wooded area. The woods were then searched by Easton police, but no large birds were found. He regretted to this very day for reporting that, because they call him the Birdman, and he eventually left the police force, and I think he sells guns now. And probably a little trigger happy. The Black Dog. This is at the top of the Bridgewater Triangle, the apex in Abington. Large dogs have been seen throughout the history of England, and they're portents of evil. If you see a black dog, something bad's going to happen to you. But if you look at Charles Dickens has it, if you look at British literature and historical accounts, people always reported seeing strange black dogs. In fact, there's a bar in Martha's Vineyard or a whole franchise called Black Dog. But anyways, this is 1976, Abington, and a man watches as a huge dog with red eyes ripped out the throats of two of his ponies. The dog was said to have been almost as big as the ponies itself, and the town of Abington was terrorized by this hellhound. And after it had been seen mauling two ponies, firefighter Philip Kane arrived on the scene, and he saw the dog standing over the animal carcasses chewing on their throats. Well, the hound eventually bounded off into the night and eluded an exhaustive police search for many weeks. Following the sighting, Abington police were flooded with calls from people claiming to catch a glimpse of the beast. And the last known sighting of the phantom pooch was by police officer Frank Curran, who spotted it along some railroad tracks. Curran fired at the dog but missed, And the dog just turned away from the officer and slowly walked away into history because it was never seen again at the end of 1976. Dover Demon. Anybody ever been to Dover, to the places there? Again, Matt Moniz and I went out and investigated the exact sighting places. There were three sighting places of the Dover Demon. I'll go over them in a moment. But we determined when the guys in this first episode saw this thing cross the road, it was probably coming from a hill area. And we also determined that it was probably following a water source, a stream, which heretofore had never been uncovered. But it's 10:30 p.m. on April 21st, 1977, Dover, Massachusetts, spring break in high school. To Dover Sherburn High School, Bill Bartlett. He's 17 years old. He's driving to his home on Walpole Street in Dover. He's with his two friends. They're drinking, smoking dope, traveling north on Farm Street, when Bill noticed what appeared to be an animal climbing over the stone wall on the left side of the road. Now, the music was loud, and I'm sure the other guys were passing the weed or whatever, but as he got closer, the car's high beams illuminated the creature. He said it was a strange being, and this is his account here, like nothing he had ever seen before. It looked like a baby's body, Bartlett said, with long arms and legs, and it had a big head about the same size as the body, and it was sort of melon-shaped. The color of it was, well, the color of people in the Sunday comics. He could see fingers in the creature's hands, and as he watched, it turned its head and looked at him with glowing orange eyes like glass marbles. Well, they were going about 40 miles per hour, and by the time Bartlett convinced his friends to turn around, about three quarters of a mile down the road, they came back and didn't see it. Well, now, it's 2 hours later that same night, 12:30 a.m. on April 22nd, 1977. John Baxter, age 15, is returning home from his girlfriend's house on Miller's Hill Road in Dover. He had been walking for about a half an hour and was less than a quarter of a mile away from his house at Miller Hill Road and Farm Street when he saw a figure about 150 feet away walking towards him. Now, Baxter noticed the figure's enlarged head and thought it might be M.G. Bouchard, a boy he knew who lived on that road and had a deformed head as a result of a childhood illness. Now, we all had friends in school. I had a kid we called Loaf because his head looked like a loaf of Nissin butter topped bread. There was another kid we called Five Past because his head listed to the side at it's five past the hour. So maybe he saw this kid, but...
I went to school with a kid whose head literally looked like Stewie from Family Guy.
Oh, did he? The football head.
We called him Field Goal.
He continued walking down the road, getting closer to the approaching figure. And quote, this is what Baxter says. As I was getting closer, I could see that it was very small. And the only thought that came into my mind was this. Is this kid walking home from a party or something? Why is he doing it at 12:30? So I called out to him, and at a distance of about 50 yards, I just kept walking, and there was no reply. And he kept walking towards me. And then suddenly, I was about 15 feet away from it when I stopped, and it stopped. And when I stopped, we just stood there, and I looked at it in amazement. I wasn't sure what I was looking at. And I said one more time, who's that? And I took another step towards it. And then at this point, I thought it was a very small person, like a 4 or 5 year old. And as I took the step, it just ran so fast into the woods on my left. It was just so fast, 1 second it was there and another second it wasn't. And I could hear it going through the woods, across a stream, a little brook. And I didn't hear the feet in the water, so I didn't know that there was a brook there. And it continued up to the edge of a field, which was about 25 or 30 feet through the edge, like trees, and at the edge of the road there's an embankment that goes down, and it was just standing on one rock that was about 2 or 3 feet from a tree and leaning against the tree, holding onto it, and staring at me. It had orange eyes. The next night, midnight, April 22nd, April 23rd, Will Tainter, 18, is driving his girlfriend home, 15-year-old Abby Brabham, to her home in Sherburn. They were going west on Springdale Avenue in Dover when Abby saw something crouched on the left-hand side of the road at the edge of a bridge. She said, as I looked at it, it kind of looked a little like an ape. And then I looked at the head, and the head was very big, and it was a very weird head, and it had these bright green eyes. Nope, she says green eyes, not orange. And the eyes just glowed like they were looking exactly at me. The head was watermelon-shaped and featureless, except for these enormous, round, green eyes. All Tainter saw was a brief glimpse of a tan figure crouched on the side of the road. So anyways, they go on and on and on, and if they figure that these... Tainter and Brabham, the boyfriend and girlfriend, John Baxter, who saw it walking towards him, and Bill Bartlett, who was out partying with his friends. They knew each other inadvertently, but it was the strangest event in Dover's history in 1977, And a lot of the police went to bat and said that these are very credible people. Bill Bartlett went on to be a very successful artist, but it's one of those things called the Dover Demon. Back to jellyfish. The largest measured East Coast jellyfish invasion struck Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Long Island on August 20th, 1978. By the 21st of August, they had reached the Cape Cod Canal in Wareham, and they were keeping people out of the water because there were Portuguese man-o-war. And some people have these horrible allergic reactions to Portuguese man-o-war, and they could die if they were struck. And then, phantom clowns. Now, phantom clowns, they come from Lauren Coleman, and then Chris Balzano has done research as well. Very sick. It's 1981. And May 5th, first of all, Brookline. Two clown men are reportedly trying to lure children into their van with candy. Brookline police had a good description of the van. Older model, black with ladders on the side, a broken front headlight, and no hubcaps. By May 8th, 1981, reports of the clown men in vans harassing children came in from East Boston, Charlestown, Cambridge, Canton, Randolph, and other cities near Boston. Police were stopping pickup trucks and vans with clowns delivering birthday greetings and clownograms, but no child molesters were ever arrested. May 9, 1981, Boston Globe headline says that police discount reports of clowns bothering kids. Meanwhile, 50 miles south of Providence, similar reports were coming to the attention of psychiatric social workers counseling the city's youth. Then, May 22, 1981, Kansas City, Missouri, a yellow van on the Missouri side stopped by two girls who ran screaming from the knife-wielding clown inside it. So, there was Boston Public Schools first week in Maine. They thought it was hysteria. So, this is clowns were seen in Charlestown, East Boston, Cambridge, Canton, Randolph, other cities, and as far west as Kansas City, Missouri, and in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. People were reporting in May of 1981 seeing these phantom clowns. Berkshire Bigfoot. This is one that I investigated, and the guy who told me about this, he wrote very poorly, and he had an advanced degree. And I often say that academia is the strong arm of ignorance, but I'll stop there. But he had advanced degrees and whatever, but he wrote like an illiterate five-year-old. I don't know how he got that far, but that's, if you have the tuition, they'll move you on. And anyways, he called me. This is in the Holly State, Holly, in the state of Massachusetts, County of Franklin, on October Mountain, in the Holly State Forest. And basically, he says, my father and his friend and I were out coon hunting. We were roading the dogs, which means that we would drive slow down miles of dirt roads with the dogs running in front of the Jeep. So holding to cut a fresh raccoon track, we came upon this large swamp that is beside one of the roads. My father calls it Hell's Kitchen, this area. And he said in his words it was a hellhole, which means very hard to walk through. As we passed this area, the dogs ran into the woods along the edge of it. A few moments later, we heard a scream come from the woods, a deathly scream where the dogs went into it. It sounded about 200 or so yards away. Both my old man and his buddy said, "What the hell is that?" They were in their early 50s then, and they'd hunted dogs all their lives. The next thing we know, all three dogs come running out of the woods with their tails between their legs. Whatever it was making sounds of breaking large branches, and we could hear the footfall as something large came towards us. Not wanting to hang out and wait, we jumped in the car and drove down the road. And we insisted, all three of us, that we felt that something was watching us. There's another one here. Bridgewater one. Well, the other one, on October Mountain. Basically, this guy's the guy that I was telling you about. He's up for a walk on October Mountain. It was in the summer of 1989. A breezy day, and he's just about coming to the crest of the mountain where there's some high, tall grass. And he sees, kneeling down, it looks to be an ape, he sees an arm come up as if something was grubbing for roots using some sort of projectile that he deemed to be a rock, hitting the dirt and hitting the dirt and hitting the dirt. And he was downwind of it, meaning that the creature couldn't smell him, because every once in a while, whatever this thing was, it had a gorilla face, would look up like, smell, and then go back to doing what it was doing. And he said he watched it for about 10 minutes, and he was frozen with fear, and eventually, after glimpsing it for so long, he said it was a profound experience. And hearing this guy talk, you know, I like to deem hoaxes and find out what their motivation is, but I could not find what this guy's motivation was for saying that, because, quote, he says, this is what he says, the animal was very tall and slightly stooped. Its body was massive and covered completely with reddish hair. I noticed that the head was also very unusual in shape and size, and the head was rather pointed and covered with hair or fur. The face was dark in color and had less hair than the top of the head. The neck seemed to be non-existent. At the moment that it turned towards me, I was absolutely terrified because it looked very human. At this point, I was so frightened, I took to measures to hide myself. It looked to be moving stones and small pieces of wood and grubbing for either roots or insects, but it was just simply too far away for me to see exactly what it was eating. But I could see its large arm moving to its mouth every so often. At this point, I wanted to get a good observation and get a little closer and study the animal. But the arms, I could tell, extended past the kneecaps. I became so frightened at this point that I began to run back on the trail. And I looked back at one point and noticed that the animal had its head back and was slowly moving back into the forest. I don't think that it was aware of me, though I wonder how it could have missed me, hearing me running through the underbrush. So, I mean, it was interesting in that regard that that was a case that I had examined. Another one, I don't think I have it here, is in Thompson, Connecticut, of a woman in her tomato garden finding her beefsteak tomatoes half bitten off, large footprints in her garden, finding hair on her fence, and finding something that had gone into her barn and had broken the necks of chickens or did an Alice Cooper or an Ozzy and just bit the heads off of it and left it in her barn. So she determined that to get into her barn, you needed an opposable thumb. You know, you need a thumb to open up the latch on it. And she called me and I talked to her, and could be a Bigfoot. The Thompson area, just if any Bigfoot researchers here, there's a T where it goes, where you have the Rhode Island, Connecticut border, and then the T in Massachusetts. I often circle that T. That's an area that I think is active with Bigfoot sightings because I've heard a lot. Douglas State Forest in that area. Anyway, she's out on her horse a couple of weeks later, and the horse starts bucking, and she smells that horrific egg smell, which is attributed to Bigfoot sightings. She feels she's being watched. The horse bucks her. She eventually fell off the horse, gets control of the horse, walks it back to her barn. The poor horse dies of a heart attack like 2 weeks later, and she swears that, you know, whatever it was along the old train tracks in Thompson, Connecticut, that she had seen a Bigfoot as well. Mike, have you heard of any activity in that area?
Not familiar.
Okay. That's the T area, as they call it. The Block Ness Monster. Block Island, June 17, 1996. We're almost done here, folks. Is this a sturgeon? Is it a basking shark? 14 feet long with a 1 foot snout. What is that thing? Huh? Could be a serpent. Nantucket Blob. November 1996. This thing washes up on shore. This is just a piece of it, but this blobster or globster washed up on the shore of Nantucket. Red-headed hitchhiker of Route 44. Who knows this? About this, the red-headed hitchhiker. Anybody want to offer up their own tale or tell me about it, or I can just go through it? People say that if you drive near the Seekonk-Rehoboth line, when you'll encounter a well-built man between the ages of 35 and 55. He has red hair and usually a beard and is dressed in a flannel red shirt with either jeans or brown work pants and work boots. Sometimes he's well-kept, but other times he appears disheveled with an overgrown beard, dirty pants, and an untucked shirt. Most times he appears solid to drivers, but not quite all there. And again, they say that you're supposed to drive by, honk your horn 3 times, leave the seat, I believe, is it behind the passenger, behind the driver, empty? I did this with Chris Balzano one night, and only thing we picked up was a buzz. But they say that it appears in the back of vehicles. Does anybody have any first-hand stories, second-hand stories of the red-headed hitchhiker, Route 44? I can tell you a few here. The earliest formal record of this occurrence is Charles Turek in his book New England Ghost Files, which I saw on Elizabeth's desk. Basically, the hitchhiker is seen outside the window of a fast-moving car. Another person picked him up only to have him vanish from their car. The most disturbing story in the book tells of a couple who broke down at 10 p.m. The woman stayed in the car while the man went to get help. They both suffered separate experiences. The man saw him on the side of the road and tried to talk to him. The red-headed man began yelling at him and then disappeared, laughing from all directions as the man made his way back to the car. The woman, meanwhile, heard his voice come over the radio, taunting her until she ran from the car. So there's a lot of second-hand, third-hand stories about the red-headed hitchhiker of Route 44. Phantom hitchhikers are known throughout England and the rural Midwest of the United States. But again, Christopher Balzano, masscrossroads.com, has an awesome article. I recommend that you read it fully. Oh, there's some other pictures. Me and Matt Moniz under 44, just different depictions, the spooky South Coast crowd, and There was an article in the Weekly Dig. This guy, Billy, wrote an article, and he did a hatchet job on Matt and I. So what I did is I took his article, put it on my website, made sure I Googled it to every search engine on the face of the earth, and basically told the story how Billy almost needed adult diapers that night. He was so scared. Nantucket Disc, July 16, 1999. What's strange about this on Nantucket is that this is corroborated by five different people had seen this disc on July 16, 1999. And basically, here's one of the stories. My wife, son, daughter-in-law, and I had just walked out of a local seafood restaurant when we saw a group of four to five well-dressed young individuals pointing at a very bright light in the eastern part of the sky. My first thought was that they were just waving to a friend who was about to land at a local airport. As I fumbled with my keys, my son and daughter-in-law said in unison, "Did you just see that?" When I glanced up to see what all the fuss was about, the aircraft had moved from where I had originally seen it to a location approximately 15 to 20 miles north. At its new location, it hovered for a few moments, then, as if someone had flipped a light switch, the light went out. A few seconds later, the light reappeared and moved back to the location where we first observed it. The distance was covered in just a matter of seconds. Seconds later, the bright light went out, giving us a clear view of its shape. Its shape resembled two pie pans, one inverted on top of the other. Having flown several missions in Vietnam, and I had a military career of 20 years, I know what I saw, and it was not an aircraft. Fascinating story. I've been to Roswell three times investigating UFOs. I've been to Gulf Breeze, Florida, site of a famous UFO case. Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia, where allegedly a UFO crashed into a harbor. Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania, where allegedly an object went into a forest in a village in 1965. I've studied cattle mutilation in the San Luis Valley. I've been to Skunk Works, Lockheed, into the Uinta Valley in Utah. And when I was in the San Luis Valley, I wanted to go out and see UFOs. I've never seen UFOs, any UFOs, and I don't want to see one. So for five nights, I was in the Skywatch, sitting out in the desert, and this is how foolish I was, in my rent-a-car, waiting for the UFOs. And basically, this area where I sat was the edge of a military range. It's a corridor between three different military bases where planes come through and they perform their bombing runs. So I thought I could get some good pictures of some military aircraft as well. So I sat out there for five nights and I saw nothing. So I went out there on my last day. I'm driving through the valley and I see this craft going overhead. And I get my camera out and take a picture of it. And it's weird. It's white with orange markings. And it's I bring it home and my father says, "That's an X-3 stiletto," and it's got experimental markings on it. Now, one thing bad about that is that the X-3 Stiletto, only four of them were manufactured, and they flew from 1957 through 1959. So, and my father said nobody would have a private plane with experimental color, so how the hell did I get a picture of a plane that supposedly was stopped manufacturing in 1959? But that was the only weird experience I had out there. So, Lemonster, flying triangles. Triangles now are the vanguard of the UFO sightings. They're seen over Phoenix in 1997, March of 1997, a massive triangle was seen cruising over Phoenix, witnessed by tens of thousands of people, including the governor. Triangles have been seen over Pennsylvania, Ohio, even the O'Hare aircraft. Some people said it was triangular in shape. Well, this happens in Leominster, Mass., and it's in the year 2000. And basically, he says, "My friend Alex went to drop off his girlfriend Chrissy, and on the way they were driving past Leominster's recently cleaned and filtered landfill. As they looked up into the sky, they reported seeing a UFO in the shape of a triangle with three lights in the bottom of it. They said it was 200 to 300 feet from the ground, hovering in one general area with almost no noise at all except a little humming. They pulled into the parking lot and watched it for further information. The front light went out, then the rest of the lights went out, and it would reappear in a different part of the sky. This happened a few times, and then the object disappeared. Prior to this event, a week before that, a guy by the name of Aaron, who works for a limousine service in Leominster, reported that on his way to Boston, he sighted the same exact thing, a triangular object with three lights that was hovering low to the ground, made no noise, it disappeared and reappeared two to three times that evening within a matter of 15 minutes. So, and then there was a third sighting. A man on an apple farm, an orchard in Leominster, also saw a triangular-shaped object hovering low over the trees. So, Beverly Cougar, 2003. Now, if you ask wildlife people, they'll tell you that the last cougar east of the Mississippi was killed in 1889 and is stuffed in Brattleboro, Vermont Town Hall. Not true. This one was seen in Manchester by the Sea. According to this guy by the name of Emma Wikes, he says that the cat came down a narrow pathway that was right next to the woods, and I think that had Frank been out, he would have been history. It's a woman, Emma, who saw this, and she's talking about her husband, Frank, my bad. The cat was looking for Frank. Fortunately, Frank was a nervous chihuahua, and he wasn't out that day. Several weeks ago, Wikes, who lives next to the woods, saw an unusual animal on her deck. She believes that it wasn't fully grown. It was like a baby puma, a baby cougar, because it was very clumsy and wasn't smooth like an adult animal would be, you know. Anyways, this was seen by three other residents in Manchester-by-the-Sea's Powderhouse Hill neighborhood. Marilyn Rourke says, "I'm still frightened. I'm frightened for my children. The thing went right through our backyard in broad daylight." Acton, 2004, they also saw one. Basically, four sightings were reported in 9 days in Acton in November 2004. November 3rd, a large cat reportedly seen on Henley Road. November 8th, residents of Mohawk Drive report growling outside their homes. Police respond and report seeing a lion, a tan, muscular-colored cat about 5 to 6 feet long. So cops are seeing this. November 9th, paw prints found behind Idlewide Farms. November 10th, Central Street resident reports seeing the cat. So four different sightings in Acton of a cougar, but the wildlife people will tell you now that it doesn't exist. September 24, 2004, a great white shark somehow got into the Falmouth Lagoon. It was first spotted off of Nauchon Island. It was tagged by the wildlife people. In fact, Woods Hole marine biologist Greg Skomal tagged it. He estimated that the shark weighed about 2,000 pounds and was about 17 feet long. Well, sharks feed on seals, and scientists speculate that a growing seal population has drawn the sharks closer and closer to Cape Cod. The last fatal shark attack in Massachusetts was in 1936 when a great white attacked a child swimming in Buzzards Bay near Mattapoisett. So this thing, anyways, was tagged off the Elizabeth Islands, and it was a spectacular animal. It spent several days in a somewhat enclosed area framed by Woods Hole before it eventually was tagged and then swam out to sea. But every once in a while, you'll see great whites come very, very close to shore. I know, more jellyfish. Last one, I promise. This is jellyfish and Portuguese man-of-war were showing up in unusual numbers in late July of 2006. On July 24th, swimmers in Rhode Island and Massachusetts were stung by the Portuguese man-of-war. The Providence Journal reported that some public beaches in Rhode Island were closed because of these Portuguese man-of-war sightings. And then a 12-year-old boy body surfing in Harwich on the Cape was stung by them. So these dangerous creatures, these man-of-war. And then Cape Cod has always had its, well, for the last 25 years, 30 years, they've called it the Beast of Truro, the Chequesset Cougar, or the Pamet Puma, but it's in Wellfleet on the Outer Cape, and it was in early November of 2007 where people reported seeing a cougar. Animal control officer L'Oreal Russell said that the man was on the back porch talking on his cell phone when a wild cat came by. He noticed it, it noticed him, and then it sprinted off into the salt marsh behind the house, but not before the man was able to capture an image of it on his camera built into his phone. He claimed that it had a beige stripe, and he described it to a T, but the animal control officer in Wellfleet swears that what this man described was a puma. Of course, I mentioned shark attacks. The last one of note was 2001, July 2001, when Joseph Fitzback and six passengers were attacked. The shark bumped its boat. Nobody got bit. July 21st, 1996, in Truro, Mass., James Orlowski, 46 years old, had his left leg and right foot bitten by a shark. February 4th, 1965, Massachusetts Granite Pier, Rockport. Scuba diving, what's the guy doing scuba diving February 65? Punctures on the left thigh. And then July 1936, the 25th, Massachusetts Hollywood Beach, just above Mattapoisett Harbor. Buzzards Bay, a kid by the name of Joe Troy is swimming the crawl stroke. It's fatal, his fingers severed, his thighs bitten, and he died during the surgical amputation of his leg. So, yes, there are sharks in these waters. Just closing, a coyote attack took place in Sandwich. In 1998, scratched a three-year-old boy's face. Coyotes are very, very prevalent now because they have no known predator except for Sarah Palin and the helicopter. A Shelburne Wolf, 2007, out in Shelburne. A man kills, this is out in Franklin County. Investigates reports that October 14, 2007, an 85-pound wild dog was killed in Shelburne by a wolf. So the farmer shot the animal on October 14th and after it had killed 13 lambs the day before. A wildlife biology confirmed that this was a large wolf, a gray wolf that was considered extinct from Massachusetts since 1840. And then bear attacks. Aren't many bear attacks here. Very little bear attacks since the 1800s. But on June 18, 2002, a 250-pound creature was confronted a Worcester police officer and scampered up a nearby maple tree. By 3 a.m. Sunday, after fruitlessly trying to find somebody to tranquilize the animal, which was nicknamed Yogi by onlookers, officers felt they had no choice and they shot the black bear to death. But bears are coming more and more in contact with humans as it's harder and harder for them to forage for natural food that they have to rely on human refuse. And I think, just finally, raccoon attacks. The raccoon, like the wolf, had no known predator except for the automobile. And an epizootic, which was an epidemic that struck the raccoon population. I don't know if you recall this, but the year 1992 to 1993, you couldn't help but drive every quarter mile and there was a poor dead raccoon on the road. And that was due to the rabies that infested and made them mad. But 90% of the raccoon population in New England was killed off by this epidemic. Errant alligators. People get pet alligators. They throw them into rivers. I got an article from the Boston Globe from 1910 of an alligator being found in the Charles River at Watertown. A pond where I used to go fishing in 2002 in Dedham near Rushcraft Road. An alligator was found, but they're usually due to people that get pets and they get tired of the pets and they just throw them in the river, throw them in a pond. Deadly snakes. There are deadly snakes in Massachusetts. The timber rattlesnake and the copperhead. Contrary to popular belief, the water moccasin is not a venomous snake. It's a harmless water snake. But those are the only two venomous snakes in Massachusetts, the timber rattlesnake and the copperhead. Alligator snapping turtles. There's a big mama in the Charles River right now, just down the street from my house. I'd have to say that the shell is probably larger than a barrel, which means it's probably close to 100 years in age. But alligator snappers, they're the biggest freshwater turtle in North America. There's an unverified report of a 403-pound alligator snapping turtle found in the Neosho River in Kansas in 1937, or the Beast of Busco in Cherubusco, Indiana. But snapping turtles, they're large, they're big, and they can snap. And then finally, poisonous spiders. The brown recluse and the black widow are both prevalent in New England. They're venomous spiders and they kill. My only exposure was when I was a boy, a man three houses up the street from us was lying on his hammock one day and he died of a spider bite. I remember my father told me of a brown recluse bit him. He died 3 days later.
What does a brown recluse look like?
It's brown and it's probably very reclusive. I'll take that for a called strike. I have no idea. I'm sure it looks like a spider and it's got brown. Anybody want to help me out on the brown recluse? Okay.
It's brown and it's small.
There we go. That's right. And then, and finally, Dennis the Manatee. Sedgwood Harbor in East Dennis, October 2nd through the 12th, 2008. He's seen in the Taunton River and Fall River on September 18th. And he was nicknamed Dennis because he was first seen in East Dennis. But anyways, a manatee was last seen in Cape Cod waters in August of 2006. And of course, it was rescued by those people at SeaWorld in Orlando where it died in SeaWorld. So, and then we won't go into this young lady here, Lizzie Borden, or the Boston Strangler, or this guy. But those are basically today's monsters. Let's look at today's monsters. Helicopter Ben, here, have a dollar, have a bailout. You want some tarp? Oh, Nancy Pelosi. Who else? That Vladimir Putin, Chavez, Fannie Mae. Ah, Brittany, then you think. Freddie Mac, OJ, Amy Winehouse. Who dat? George Michael, AIG, Ahmadinejad, A-Rod,
Paris. Jim Cramer. Who's that guy? Who's that guy? Who's that guy? Phil Spector. And then the guy with all the names. And, of course, her. And that's my talk for tonight. You guys have been a great audience. Thank you so much for being patient with me with my jargon and my asides. But does anybody have any questions or comments?
I've got a comment.
A comment, yes, sir.
Did that lady actually make it to George's Island?
The lady in black?
Yeah.
Yeah, she did. And what she actually made it to the cell where her husband was being held, made plans to escape. They were tunneling out, and apparently some northern soldiers heard them tunneling, and that's when she raised the gun to fire, and it misfired. And it backfired and killed her husband. The ball probably went out the side of the revolver.
I've been to that island. What part of the island was that on?
Fort Warren. See, what I'm trying to tell you, brother, is I ain't been there.
Oh, you haven't?
No, but my brother's done extensive research on it. It's in Fort Warren. I don't know exactly what side of the island.
Yeah, because a fort basically takes up the majority of it.
Yeah, so, but I'm sure that if some of the friends of Boston Harbor, if you took a tour out there, they would probably relay some stories about that.
She's basically seen all of them.
She is?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah? What are some other anecdotes that you know of?
The robes that she was wearing was actually made from the curtains in the dining hall because she wanted to die with dignity. Instead of wearing, she came...
Oh, that's right. Oh, yes, yeah, I forgot a key element. She was dressed like a man, and she wanted to be dressed like a woman when she was put together. To death. You're
that's
right.
That's the whole black thing.
They were curtains.
Yeah, they were the curtains from the dining hall.
Interesting.
The blackout curtains.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah, for the war, yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Anybody have any other questions? Elizabeth was thinking about putting together a tour of the Bridgewater Triangle, like... I could show you where all these areas, like the Thunderbird, the Black Dog happened, Dover Demon. I know of all the Bigfoot sightings or alleged Bigfoot sightings, again, I'm saying that have happened within the Triangle. There's an area in Bridgewater near Lake Nip off of Route 104 that's where predominantly 75% of all the sightings happen. But supposedly it's a strange area, you know, and others will argue it's the Bridgewater Trapezoid or the Bridgewater Octagon or the Bridgewater Oval. She's thinking about putting together a tour sometime for that. So if you're interested, by all means, give her your email address. In closing, I'm here next Thursday night for the Air Raid of Los Angeles. I'm here on June 25th. We're going to do another historical UFOs on the Foo Fighters and listen to Foo Fighters music, Sirius, and the Scandinavian Ghost Rockets. And then on July 25th, I believe it's a Friday, July 22nd. It's a Wednesday. I'm going to be here doing New England Bigfoot sightings, which is kind of cool. That's never been done before. And I've just pulled together all the information. And you'd be surprised that Bigfoot's been sighted in New England since around 1852. So thanks for coming, everybody. I appreciate it. And it's good to have it free, too, huh? So if you want to come next week, or if you want to come to any of my other talks, give Elizabeth your email, or I can give you a card. I also have Bridgewater Triangle CDs, he said as he segued over. We're selling these tonight if you're interested. They're $5, but honest to God, they'll creep you right out. Chris Belzano narrated this along with Chris Pittman. But we talk about the Dark Woods, Freetown Forest, Red-Headed Hitchhiker, a haunted hospital, haunted cemetery, haunted schoolhouse, haunted police station, Shad Factory Pond, Roadrunners, which are creatures that run alongside your car, Bigfoot, Thunderbirds, Puckwudgies, Chris talks about, stones, phantom fires, yada, yada, yada. If you're interested, it's a pretty cool CD. Thanks, everybody. Take care.